You're listening to KCBX Central Coast Public Radio here on NPR One. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the first Earth Day. A half century ago, environmental degradation in the United States had reached such an alarming point to so many people that a day was set aside to focus on protecting the planet. In 1990, the April 22nd celebration went global, and events were organized in countries around the world. The man behind both the creation and the growth of the annual Earth Day is Dennis Hayes. KCBX's Greta Mart spoke via Zoom with Hayes from his office in Seattle in what's considered the world's greenest building. Here's their conversation.
Should we just start? What were you doing, and how did you get involved with Earth Day?
Well, remember, in the 1960s, America was being torn apart by some fairly powerful social forces, the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, and had a degree of cultural upheaval, the Summer of Love in San Francisco, Woodstock. And amid all of that, there was really only, I think, one politician who had this sense that there was a growing disquiet in America between the growth of gross domestic product and the declining quality of American life, the way that we were undermining the biological integrity of so much of the country. That was Gaylord Nelson, a senator in Wisconsin. At least according to one of the origin myths, he was flying over the Santa Barbara oil spill when he suddenly had the idea of having a college university teach-in on the environment. I think his thinking was very much that in the early days of the anti-war movement, there had been these teach-ins between debates between people who believed in the domino theory that if you lost Vietnam, you would quickly lose Laos and Cambodia and Thailand and Malaysia, and people who thought of it as a neo-imperialist war where the Chinese had dominated Vietnam and then the French did and then the Japanese did and then the French again, and now the Americans were moving in. Out of all of that came a fairly strong anti-war sentiment. So he proposed this, gave a bunch of speeches about it. I read a newspaper report of one of those speeches. I determined some years earlier that I wanted to devote my life to what we would now call urban ecology, industrial ecology, human ecology, trying to bring the economic sphere into equilibrium with the natural world. And this environmental teach-in seemed to be in keeping with that. So I flew down to Washington, D.C. when I was a graduate student and got a courtesy 15-minute interview with Senator Nelson. And my hope was to get the charter to go back and organize Harvard, since I hadn't really seen anything about this teach-in at Harvard. And it turned out he did not have an organizer for Harvard or for Cambridge or for Boston or Massachusetts or New England. And he was giving speeches saying that this would be a good thing to have happen. So I went back with a charter to organize Boston, and a couple of days later got a call asking whether I'd consider dropping out of college and coming down to Washington, D.C. to organize the United States. And that seemed like the crispest step that I could possibly make into the career that I was hoping for, and I dropped out of school pretty much immediately and went to D.C.
Had you grown up in Boston?
No. I'd grown up in the Columbia River Gorge near Portland, Oregon, and done my undergraduate work at Stanford in California. I was just actually in my second month at Harvard at the time that I read this newspaper article.
Did you ever go back once you dropped out?
Yes, but it was a foolhardy exercise. After Earth Day, we got involved in a couple of campaigns. One was to defeat a dirty dozen members of Congress, and another was to pass the Clean Air Act of 1970. And with way too much audacity, I thought that I could become a full-time student at Harvard Law School and a full-time executive director of the organization running these two campaigns. And it took about a month before I realized that this was not going to work. Among other things, I just didn't have the money to be doing the constant flying back and forth.
So you went down and to organize the national, and did you work with Nelson, or who were the people around you, and how did you go about it?
Yeah, Nelson was quite a wonderful delegator. I probably met him for that first interview and maybe two other times before Earth Day. He raised the money and he basically gave us our heads. And ironically, I pulled in several key people, roughly my age, between 20 and 25, who'd done a lot of campus organizing around a variety of issues and sent them out into different regions of the country. And it was really just a matter of weeks before it had become clear that that the whole idea wasn't going to work. Campuses were still torn up by the anti-war movement and civil rights movement, the efforts to get more professors of color and students of color integrated into campuses. And teach-ins were something that had been done 6, 7, 8 years earlier when there was something debatable, but there wasn't anybody who wanted to debate the proposition that pollution is a really good thing and we got to have more of it. So this environmental teach-in basically died a quick death. But meanwhile, interestingly, an advertising man of some distinction dropped by our offices one day and asked whether there was anything that he could do to be helpful. And I said, well, I think we've got a brand that isn't helping us with this environmental teach-in. If you can come up with some other way that we can call ourselves, it might give us a better shot. And he came back literally a week or two later with a series of full-page ads. And one of them was Earth Day, and another one was E-Day, one was Green Day, one was Ecology Day. He clearly preferred Earth Day, and we had all the staff in and had pizza and beer and for a couple of hours, debated the pros and cons and finally resolved on Earth Day. And he helped write the advertising executive again, some really feisty words to follow that on the ad. And we basically bet the shop. We spent maybe close to half of all the money that we had on a full page ad in what was then called the News of the Week in Review in the Sunday New York Times. And thus was Earth Day born. That ad produced so much revenue. We had a little coupon down in the corner that you can clip out and send to us. And we raised meaningfully more money from the ad than it cost us to place it. But even better, lots of community newspapers, lots of magazines were so intrigued by the name and the feistiness of our approach to the issue that they reprinted it for free. And so we got all of those little coupons as well. It was a very significant moneymaker for us.
People would clip out the coupon and then just mail you a check?
Yeah, mail us a check, and it would have their names and addresses, and then we would put them on a mailing list and send them weekly newsletters and get them involved and try to encourage them to do something in their own communities. I mean, we analyzed the mail that had gone into the senator's office as well as the mail that was coming in response to these ads. And it turned out that the real interest in all of this stuff wasn't initially on universities, where they were still entirely focused upon a war that we all thought was beginning to wind its way down, but wasn't winding itself very fast. And the real interest in environmental issues came out of young women, mostly between the ages of maybe 25 and 35, mostly college educated, mostly with one or two young children, mostly in single wage earner families, most of which never organized anything before in their lives. And a huge number of really skilled organizers came out of that initial group. In fact, for many years, every time that I met a member of a city council or a state legislature or a public utility commission or Congress who was a woman in the right age category, she would come up, introduce herself, and say that the first thing political she had ever done in her life was Earth Day.
Wow. And what was that ad man's name?
The advertising executive was Julian Koenig, K-O-E-N-I-G. And interesting little factoid about Julian, he was responsible for a whole bunch of wonderful advertising campaigns, but Advertising Age, sort of the Bible of the advertising industry, chose his campaign for Volkswagen, which was headlined Think Small, as the outstanding advertising campaign of the 20th century. And I think even on to his death, the campaign that he was probably most proud of was Earth Day.
You're listening to KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Greta Mart. I'm speaking with Dennis Hayes, who was responsible for organizing the first Earth Day back in 1970. He's now the president and CEO of the Bullet Foundation. That's a philanthropic organization based in Seattle, Washington. Let's get back to our conversation.
And I was always under the impression that it started in Santa Barbara that it was a local thing, but it sounds like it was more, it came out of DC. It was more of a national thing. So can you differentiate the two?
Well, again, there were a bunch of little starter engines that created the context within which Earth Day became possible. The Cuyahoga River catching on fire, some studies showing that the Great Lakes appeared to be dying, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, clearly one of them that was, in terms of timing, just immediately ahead of 1970 was in 1969, the big Santa Barbara oil spill. And clearly that was a formative thing that was on much of the news coverage of Earth Day. And the people of Santa Barbara, a group, as I recall, called GOO, Get the Oil Out, was responsible for your first Earth Day. And then, and in fact, you had a conference. The first conference that I ever spoke at advocating Earth Day organizing was at the Santa Barbara City College.
I see. Okay. The first Earth Day, was that the largest one, or did it get bigger every year? Or what? Tell me about the evolution of the day itself.
The first one was something that caught everyone a little bit off guard. We had thought of this as an event that would take place one day, like the Vietnam Moratorium or the New Mobilization Against the War, the March on the Pentagon, the March on Selma, the Poor People's March. But you would come, you would do it, you would leave your impact, generate just as much media exposure as you could, and that would be it. And in fact, when a lot of people started calling me about organizing another Earth Day in 1971, I strongly discouraged it, because the first Earth Day had 20 million participants. There had simply never been a planned and organized event that large in American history.
Yeah, until the Women's March of 2017?
Probably. That very much like Earth Day was something that you found in every city, every town, every crossroads in the country. But until Earth Day, these things were mostly done in either in one location like Selma or Washington, D.C., or in a handful of major cities like the Vietnam Moratorium. But we permeated basically the entire society. And I just knew that in 1971, you would be very lucky to get something half the size or a third the size. And the news coverage would then be, well, turns out the environment was just a fad. These folks just don't have the kinds of enthusiasm they had before. But of course, the second of anything never is the same as the first.
I didn't realize that, because I was so disappointed for the second Women's March. I was so energized the first one, and then the second one was such a disappointment. And so I didn't realize that the same thing happened back then.
Same thing happens to almost anything if you have that first burst of enthusiasm, and then it's been done. But in any case, people kept on doing it and doing it over time. There was a national organization that sprang up to try to push something together in 1980. I was at that point part of the Carter administration running the solar and renewable energy program, so I wasn't actively engaged in it, but it was another grassroots effort. And then in 1990, we probably had an event that was significantly larger than 1970, but that's on a different base. In 1990, I got engaged once again, but on the condition that it really become Earth Day and we could take it international. In 1970, though, we called it Earth Day. It was really United States Environment Day. In 1990, we got events in 144 countries and really tried to pull people together to understand that there are some problems that we have to address, not as our individual tribes, but as a species. And that was very large. Episodically, since we occasionally have one that is really striking and important, it tends to be Earth Days that have zeros in them. So 1990, 2000, 2010, and then before COVID-19 basically devastated us, we had planned to have the biggest ever by far in the 50th anniversary in 2020, where we had commitments for large crowds by everybody from Pope Francis to fill up St. Peter's Square to Kolkata to New Delhi to Rio de Janeiro to Berlin. I think we had a decent shot at having north of a billion people participating. And then COVID-19 came roaring out of China and took over the entire planet. And essentially everything that we had spent a couple of years pulling together and organizing overnight became illegal. And so Earth Day 2020 will be a virtual event, but and some of it will, I think, be fairly interesting in a variety of local activities. And at earthday.org, there will be several hours of streaming of various speeches from around the planet and some musicians speaking and playing in their living rooms and some video clips and what have you. But the impact is nothing like having 750,000 people on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. It'll be low-key.
Right. It sounds devastating. Are you heartbroken?
Well, you know, I'm 75 years old. I was 25 for the first one, so I'm not going to get another one of these big ones. This was going to be my finale. And I have a full-time job, but I spent part of my job with the permission of my board and all of my evenings and weekends for probably close to 3 years working on this. The overall desire was to focus upon climate change as something that really requires a global response. It just doesn't make any difference whether you burn a ton of coal in China or Germany or the United States. It's exactly the same. And so we needed to pull everybody together and have this shared, if you will, global Green New Deal with bold action. After 40 years of reports and conferences, but not really doing much, we really wanted to do for policy on climate in 2020 what we had done broadly for the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Toxic Substances Control Act, and on with Earth Day 1970. And so, yeah, it is not going to happen the way that I had hoped that it would. And it is kind of a crushing thing, but nothing you can do.
Right. Do you think that it could happen next year or be postponed till later in the year? Or is it just, it needs to be April 2020?
Well, all things are theoretically possible. There's a difficulty with, we have a permit for the mall for August 24th, and several people want to go ahead with at least that as a big thing, pulling this out a couple of weeks before the election in the United States. But there are some models of COVID-19 that suggest that late September, early October, we might have a second resurgence of the disease, in which case, once again, the National Park Service would yank the permit. And to put these things together, you know, we focus upon the people and the grassroots nature of it and how it works. But if you want to have a huge event like that, one, you need to get the permits, you need to get insurance, you need to get porta potties, you need to get marshals to provide security, you need to get Jumbotron so that people at the far edges of the crowd can still see what's going on stage. All of that costs a fair amount of money. And we raise that money and put everything together for April 22nd. And some of that having been laid out in contracts, there's no way we can get it back. And it's going to be hard to find someone who is prepared to help underwrite it for October 24th, when there's once again a chance that COVID virus could be resurging. So maybe something will happen in 2021. I promised my wife that after 50 years of Earth Day, I would go off into gentler pastures after this year. So it will be up to someone else to and we have the Earth Day Network with a lot of talented people. They may well try to put something together like this next year.
You're listening to KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Greta Mart. You're listening to a conversation with Dennis Hayes, who was responsible for organizing the first Earth Day back in 1970.
How do you feel, or what are you thinking about while the pandemic is upending all life as we know it? At the same time, it's an extraordinary event happening to the environment, a boon to the environment, and that maybe it's what it'll take for people to really realize, to really get climate change. How are you thinking about this in terms of the good coming out of this?
I think it will be, if I'm truly candid, something of a stretch to be able to move from COVID-19 into climate change. There's no organic relationship between the two. There are some behaviors, there are some institutional things. You know, you and I are having this conversation on a technology that didn't exist a year ago, and it's a superb way to conduct meetings. And so it may well be that there's a lot more of that where people will get together on one of these platforms rather than jump on a bus or jump in a car and go across town to have meetings. All that will be good. The other side of that is that I have historically always gone down to the bus stop in the morning, jumped on the bus, and gone into the office. COVID-19 suddenly makes buses a potentially more dangerous place, and it will take a little while for that to wear off. I think we're seeing an explosion of green buildings in recent years, really dark green buildings in the last couple of years, and I think they will now be increasingly dark green healthy buildings with a lot of attention being paid to the air quality inside of buildings. So that'll be a plus. And there's that whole mixture. Environmentally, where I see it is potentially having, if the movement plays its cards right, where I think there may be a direct correlation between environmental goals and COVID-19 is that it is a zoonotic disease that passed apparently from bats through some sort of a pathway into humans. And we've seen a few of these things before with SARS and MERS and Ebola. And there is a potential for a fair number of different kinds of pandemics with different microorganisms that can reside both in humans and in animals and to which humans have not built any resistance. So when a brand new one comes along, we're going to take a while to develop a vaccine for it. Some of that is, and in fact, probably much of that is due to humans moving in on the natural habitat of wild animals that then come into far closer contact with humans. And that's when this exchange of those microorganisms takes place. And at the same time, moving into those habitats is how we are driving so many species into what is quite literally almost an epidemic of extinction that is going on now, largely unobserved. And so if we can do something out of this that preserves far greater natural areas unintruded upon by human beings. And Ed Wilson, E.O. Wilson, the great conservation biologist, has argued for massive reserves. He thinks that at least one half of the surface area of the earth ought to be preserved in a natural form, and that people ought to be living in, having their industries in, cultivating the other half of the earth, but the one species, 50% should be enough. That would be a massive kind of transformation of public consciousness. I think it would be a desirable one. And that's the sort of thing that I think a strong campaign coming out of COVID-19 and perhaps a couple of subsequent pandemics could lead people to appreciate and build momentum for.
Okay, I see. So what about air quality? What about, do you think people will really see a difference in air pollution?
Well, there's meaningful improvements in air quality around the world as people have sheltered in place and stopped driving their automobiles, stopped having so many plane flights, stopped having so much public transit, stopped having so much industrial activity of certain kinds in key places. That appears to be a temporary phenomenon. And if you look at the stock market in the last couple of days, it's anticipating that all of that is going to be returning to its status as before. We have long had drives in parts of the world, probably no place more than in the United States, to improve air quality. And if you, in fact, drive a car today, even a powerful car, it produces only a small percentage as much pollutant as it did driving that same distance in 1970. That's one of the places where there has been spectacular improvement. But air quality in a great many places, including close to your neck of the woods down in the Los Angeles basin, is still quite miserable. And where you've got terrible air quality, you have a prevalence of lung diseases like asthma. And if you've got a lung disease, then you are more susceptible to respiratory pandemic. And so that linkage is relatively clear. Whether it will lead to an even greater tightening of standards here and an enhancement of standards in places like New Delhi and Sao Paulo, where air really is awful, time will tell. But hopefully this disease, looking for silver linings wherever we can find it, does give one more very compelling reason to get clearer air.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm speaking with Dennis Hayes. He was a key figure in organizing the first Earth Day back in 1970 and in many of the global celebrations since. Let's get back to our conversation.
There are a lot who are watching with horror the rollbacks of all the environmental standards and things that have been put into place. At the beginning, you talked about the intersection of the economy with ecology. Can you talk a little bit about that, about what people can do besides obviously voting and perhaps changing the administration? But, I mean, what's going to happen with this?
Well, I have long been a firm proponent of walking your talk. So, for example, if you care about climate change and you believe that walking away from the Paris Accords was a bad thing, even though the Paris Accords themselves were voluntary and inadequate, nonetheless, they were at least a small step in the right direction. But you have that value system, then you should be paying attention to your own impact as well. And that's everything from what food do you eat, how much of it is red meat with a huge carbon footprint, and how much of it is vegetarian with a much, much tinier footprint, particularly if it's local and organic. What kind of transportation do you use when you're getting around your city? How much do you fly, and do you try to reduce that whenever you possibly can and try to offset it when you can't avoid it? To what extent do you have a house that is appropriate to your actual needs and make it just as efficient as possible and take advantage in a place like California, particularly with some significant incentives to putting solar panels on your roof? And, heavens, in Seattle, which doesn't begin to have the sunlight of most of California, this is the cloudiest major city in the contiguous 48 states. I have a six-story office building that I developed that gets 100% of its electricity from the sun, 100% of all of its energy from the sunlight that falls on its roof. And my home does as well. We have the technology now to be able to do these things. So I'm hoping that everyone will really live their values. Among other things, that gives you a sense of what it is that you're calling for. You're demonstrating that this stuff works. And when you talk to other people, you're speaking from a position of integrity rather than hypocrisy. But having said all of that, the rolling back now of more than 100 environmental laws, regulations, rules, court decisions from the past being reversed, that's not a random thing that can be somehow ameliorated significantly by individual actions, even by aggregate individual actions of millions of people. But that's a decision that's being made on high by the president and the people that he appoints to key positions. He's literally setting out consciously to roll back comprehensively 50 years of environmental progress. And if that's not something that you are enthusiastic about, then you ought to be. If you've never before been involved in voter registration, this is the year to do it. If you've never before been involved in raising money for a political candidate, this is the year to do it. If you've never before been involved in a get out the vote effort, 2020 is the year to do it, because if 2020, 2021 doesn't become an inflection point in carbon emissions and greenhouse gas emissions generally for the world, we will be probably passing some very important tipping points that are irreversible and be permanently impoverishing the planet.
That was Earth Day founding organizer Dennis Hay speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart. April 22nd marks the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. While in-person celebrations have been canceled this year, the Santa Barbara Earth Day is happening virtually, featuring renowned environmentalists, musicians, artists, and authors. The event begins live streaming at noon on Wednesday at sbearthday.org. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. It's at kcbx.org.